Life in the 60s. File identification. This is an interview with Ken Sadler on the 20th of January 2016 for the Upper Hutt in the 1960s Oral History Project. The interviewer is Karen Wilton, and we're recording this at Ken's house in Masterton using a Zoom H4N recorder with AKG C417 PP clip on mics, and this is file one. So Ken, can I just get you to start by saying your full name and when and where you were born?
Right. Oh, wow. Oh, that's telling, isn't it? But yes, my full name is Kenneth Lawrence Sadler. I was born in Thornton Heath, that's just out West Croydon in England, Surrey, England. Do you want to know when I was born?
Yes, please, your date of birth.
1925, on the 18th of December.
18th of December, 1925. That's right.
So if you start working that out, you'll see how old I am now. Although, do you really age? You're still,
yeah.
You know.
Goodness. And so, you emigrated from England.
Yes.
In the 50s.
That's right, 1952.
Why did you decide to come to New Zealand?
Well, it's a very long story in a way. As a younger boy, I decided I wanted to be a marine engineer. And so to do that, I had to serve an apprenticeship. Now, the war was on, but it didn't matter. I was 16 years of age. I went to Newcastle and served an apprenticeship for 5 years there because I thought I was going to be called up, but I didn't realise I was in a reserved occupation at that time. So I didn't get called up. But I went through my apprenticeship and did my night schools and got my mechanical engineering national and so forth, which was very helpful for when I wanted to set my tickets at going to sea. Anyway, I went to sea and had just on 5 years at sea, I suppose it was. After 3 years, I had enough time to set my seconds ticket, which I did, got it. Then I sailed again as a second engineer for a little while. And then I decided I needed to get some turbine experience. And also I wanted to have a look at New Zealand because my eldest brother, who I had met when I was 21 years of age, he actually came to New Zealand before I was born. 2 years before I was born. So I was very keen to go and have a look at New Zealand, and the fact that I'm a marine engineer, I get a free trip out there. So I joined the New Zealand Shipping Company and came to New Zealand. And that was in 49. And if you remember rightly, that's when the big strike was on in New Zealand and all the shipping was out for about 9 months.
Yeah.
So we were caught out here for the best part of 3 months. Oh, no more, nearly 6 months. In fact, it took us 6 weeks to get here. We arrived in Auckland, went straight in, got supplies, filled up with water, then we backed out to anchor off Rangitoto, and we sat there at anchor for 7 weeks. So longer than it took us to get out here. So anyway, we'd naturally done all the repair work we needed. We had nothing to do as engineers on board. So our chief engineer said, you know, if you want to take any time off, you can. And so I naturally contacted my brother, and he went down and saw him. And
where was he living?
He was living at Fielding. No. At Kākāriki. Kākāriki.
Where's Kākāriki?
That's good. It's between, just out of Halcombe. You got.
It's around there, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Close to Marton.
Manawatū.
But that's right. The Manawatū area. He was the engineer, the manager of a crushing plant that he'd built there. So I had a good look around, and of course, in those days, New Zealand was a glorified place for young engineers, building the hydro plants, the freezing works, and the Borthwicks, and that. I had a good look around there, and I thought, wow, this will do me, chief engineer on one of these plants. This is what I want. So when we sailed, we came back to New Zealand, back to England. I then had enough time for my chief engineer's ticket, so I went on to school and got that. Took me a little bit longer because I had met Jean about 2 years earlier, and so naturally, although I was very keen on getting my ticket, at the same time I was very keen on seeing Jean in the evenings, and it took a little bit longer, I suppose, to get the ticket. But I got it.
And distracted.
That's right. So I then suggested to Jean, I said, "Well, look, why don't we, when we get married, Actually, let me backtrack there. I was just thinking, she was the youngest of a family, only of three, but I was the baby of 11 children. And I'm very much the baby because I was born 7 years after my sister, who was the 10th. So when I arrived, you can imagine, I had all elder sisters and people like that looking after me. So I was really the baby of the family. And so I could see myself, once we got married, I'd have a lot of people advising us how to live married life. And I thought, well, if we went to New Zealand for a couple of years and go out there and we make our fortune, you see, and then we can come home, now we're truly married people, 2-3 years older, and we won't have everybody telling us how to live. So that was what I suggested to Jean, and that's what brought us to New Zealand. Well, we came out here, and so happened I had an introduction to Borthwick's here in Masterton, went to see them, and unfortunately the chief engineer wasn't available, the superintendent wasn't available, and nobody else could sign me on as a watchkeeping engineer. They could give me a fitter's job up in New Plymouth or something, but I didn't want that. I wanted an engineer's job, you see. So I said, well, I'm going to Wellington because I can't afford to hang around. And so we went down to Wellington to have a look see if there's anything other jobs. And, well, another story, but I ended up by going to see Vacuum Oil and mainly to get some information on some jobs that I'd been offered, because I knew somebody that worked there. Anyway, this person turned around and said, you know, well, why go there? Why not come and join an oil company? So I looked at him and said, an oil company? What do you mean? I'm an engineer. What an oil company's got to do with that? He said, well, I'm an engineer too, and what we need is what we call lube engineers. And I thought, a lube engineer. What's this? So I decided I'd sign on. And this is what we did. We signed on, and just carried on working with Mobil. And it's the brightest thing I really ever did. Because
and so you got transferred around a few places and then ended up in Upper Hutt.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, how did you end up in Upper Hutt?
Well, in Upper Hutt? Yeah. Well, mainly just looking for a house. And the centre was still in, the headquarters was still in Wellington itself. And so I was transferred here to finally work from the head office block. It was a matter of finding a house, and the first house we looked at in our part to start with, sort of the very first house when we'd been moved from Fielding, right? And we started looking around Upper Hutt, and because they had all these Hutt hardware buildings going up, and nothing really interested us. But we then looked around Linden, and that's where we found a brand new house being built at Linden. And this was then our first house in 1953, 54, somewhere around about then. No, it wasn't, to be exact. I think it's 55. And so we had that house in Linden. We were there a couple of years before I was moved again. And we went up to Palmerston. And from Palmerston, we were there for 5 years. And that's when I was transferred again. It was promotion, actually, but we came down to Wellington. And today you have a management job. But this was to be resident in Wellington. The offices in Wellington, could be anywhere from the North Cape to the Bluff. The job had me going everywhere, including overseas. But so we needed another house when we came back to Wellington, and so we found this one in Upper Hutt.
So what attracted you to Upper Hutt?
Sorry?
What attracted you to Upper Hutt specifically?
What attracted us?
Yeah. Why did you decide to get a house there?
Well, it was a growing place. It was young. It was a young city, or a young town, it seemed to us. I mean, to us being for English people, to call it a city, we just laughed. You know, it was just a little country, rural town, I suppose. But it was growing. It was all new. We talked about these houses, you know, being put up by timber and hardware. Although they were sort of a patterned house, they were all different, but they were all new, and they were sort of appealing to the younger people. I think certainly appealed to us. The house I didn't see it. Jean was the one that actually found it. She went on searching around and found this house. And the thing that really took her, I think, was not the interior of the house, it was the external. Seeing the lich gate and all the beautiful brickwork for the fence line and so forth, it was quite becoming.
Lich gate, what's that?
A lich gate? Well, it's a thing that they usually have at the beginning of the opening to a church, don't they? You know, if you think down at the of the roadway, and you've got the path up to a church, down at the gateway you have what is known as a lich gate, and that's is set to do with funerals. Actually, in the good old days, that's where they had the coffin, and all the coffin bearers assembled there to get the coffin on their shoulder and so forth before they then moved into the church.
Oh.
So it's somewhere that they could be undercover, and it's called a lich gate.
Yeah.
If you with me.
So it's like a little roof.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. But it's an ornamental roof. And the one we had there, of course, was a pretty small compared to what they had it outside the churches and so forth. So anyway, that's what brought us here. And
what was your house like?
What was the house like?
Yeah,
it was just a typical first buyer's house, three bedrooms, lounge. And in fact, one of the bedrooms went off the lounge, if I remember rightly. It had the washing house, and it was very keen and tidy. It was right backing onto the Hutt River, which we thought, oh, this is marvellous. A few years later, we learnt that it's not too good to be close to a river because they can flood. But, however, we didn't get flooding in the house, although we did get it in the garden, the back garden, at one stage. But it was wonderful for bringing the children up because they had the whole of the valley to sort of run around. That was their playground. And so this is how we saw the place, that it was ideal for bringing a family up. It was new. We made friends very quickly of our own age group, and in fact, I belonged to them, belonged to the Masonic Lodge, and so that was a wonderful introduction because I found several of them living round there, and so I transferred my loyalty to their particular lodge room and stayed with them for many, many years. I could still be with them now, I suppose, but I have joined another lodge here in Masterton, so I decided I'd just keep the one going, although I keep fraternal visits naturally to the one in her hut. But as I say, there were so many people around us of our age group, with our interests and things like that, that we didn't see before we got there, but we had a feeling that we were going to be there, and we were right. It was the right feeling.
So there must have been a lot of people moving into Upper Hutt from other areas.
Oh, well, there must have been, yes, that's true. And it was a growing first house city, really, calling it a city, which it wasn't then. But that's what made it the city, I suppose. I don't know what the population thinking of the children, but being a young one, I suppose everybody, whatever the population was, you could double it for the number. I'm thinking about the adults. You could double that for the amount of children that were there. That's why it could support, two, three colleges. You had St. Pat's, you had Herotonga, which we were the favourite. There was the Upper Hutt College, and then numerous primary schools, and they were all full too, all full.
A lot of young families in your street?
Sorry?
Were there a lot of young families in your neighbourhood?
Yes. Next door, we had the Bakers next door. There was two young boys there. And on the other side, on the south side, the Grenvilles, there was three young children there, all of our same age as our children. I could go just about every second house down the road. They were just one big happy team, In fact, it was interesting because when did TVs start coming in?
In the 60s, I think.
In the 60s, that's right. So around about 64 when it was starting to get up. We hadn't got a TV, but you could see the aerials going up on the odd house. And usually it was one of his friends again. So we never used to see our children at 4 o'clock. From 4 till 5, they're always round like a beehive, you see, around a honeycomb. And all the kids there until they had to go home at 5 o'clock for their tea and bed, of course.
So did all the kids play together?
They played together, yes, very much so. And they sort of formed themselves into groups because you had, like our youngest one, Karen, she was very, very keen on horses, very keen. Well, so was Elise too, the second one. But Karen was so keen that she actually went out doing babysitting and all sorts of things at a very young age, and cleaning and so forth, just get some money. And she finally saved up £5 or something. And that's what she bought her first horse for, £5.
Did she?
But we just turned around to her and said, we can't afford to keep a horse. I said, oh, no problem there, Dad, because there's a paddock down the road. All my friends have got their horses, and I can put my horse on their paddock, you see. I said, but what about the saddle? And they said, oh, no problem. I can borrow a saddle, you see, and I got this. So she had the answers to everything. It wasn't going to cost us anything. So we went and bought this first horse, and the way she went. So that's another long, long story about her horses. But it never did cost us anything. The kid ended up owning three horses. She had her own, leasing her own paddock from one of the local brewers, which wasn't being used. It's a spare land. And then leasing the land out again to her friends for their horses. And that didn't cost her anything. And I'm still laughing away, thinking, isn't it marvellous? Look at all our horses. But it was all our daughter, and it had nothing to do with me.
Business empire or something.
Oh, yeah, she's just a very good little planner, and she was a good saver, and she could organise and so forth. I don't know where she got it from. I must have been a mother.
That's great. But, and so you were working in Wellington?
Yes.
Did you commute? How did you commute into town?
Well, I had my own car. I had a company car. I had a company car right from the word go. I had a company car, but they're all our own cars. We purchased the car, but it was run on a company scheme, so we were reimbursed with all our mileage and things like that. All business miles and all petrol and all the stuff like that was reimbursed, even the cost of registration and so forth. So, and I had that privilege the whole time I worked for them, over for 35 years. I had a car, changed a new car every second year and so forth. And yet it really, other than the initial deposit outlay, it never cost me a thing. So no problem with transport.
So did a lot of people that you knew commute into Wellington for work?
Yes, they did. They used the train. I eventually did pick up with some of the mobile chaps who were living in the Hutt Valley, and I used to pick them up on odd occasions, going in or bringing them home at night or something like that. But it wasn't a sort of a regular thing, you know, because my hours were so odd, it didn't always fit in with theirs. If it did, you know, on a Monday morning or Friday yesterday, that was no problem. In fact, Fridays on some of those earlier days, it's a known thing that you made straight for the Heratonga pub, didn't you? Stopped off there and have a couple of drinks quickly before 6 o'clock, and then back on home. But that particular job, although it's nothing to do with this interview, I did a lot of travelling, but it was all around the country. So I would be flying to Auckland or Christchurch on a Sunday afternoon and coming back on a Friday night. Jean, my wife, really brought the kids up during the week. But as soon as I got home, you know, it was my time over the weekends.
So what did you do at the weekends?
Well, usual things, jobs around the house. But we tried where possible really to take the children out. We used to go out a lot for picnics and things like this and visiting. My brother had a beach house at Himatangi. And this used to be quite a draw. We could tear up there on a Friday night and stay till Sunday afternoon, you see, at Timotei. So, again, a lovely beach area. So the kids, I think, enjoyed their lives as younger children because we did get out a lot with them.
What kind of places would you go to have picnics?
So what sort of places? Oh, anywhere from Maidstone Parks to Pike Arkariki, I suppose. Or we go down to... what do you call the place? Well, say Pike Arkariki here. That'll do. But over to the coast, Waikanae and places like that. But at summertime, every summer, we always went away somewhere. We never stayed home. And we went to numerous places, camping sometimes. Others, we were leasing a holiday house or holiday batch, you know. Had some terrible experiences with some of those too, because when we arrived, they were in such a terrible state. We had to spend the first 2 days cleaning them up, you know, and so on.
I know that feeling.
You know, it's like, but it made for the holiday, really, because we all worked together to get the place as we wanted it. The kids would get their bedroom right, and we would get the rest of the house into respectable order. Jean would scour the kitchen right out, literally.
Yeah.
And so we always left the places in a lot better state than what we received them in. But anyway, we did a lot of moving around like that.
What schools were your kids at?
What schools?
What schools?
Well, they started at Fraser Fraser School, was it? Yeah, that's the primary school. But then they went for secondary work, they went to Hiratonga College. I got myself very involved at this. Once they got to college, I started getting involved with parent and teachers associations. And so parent and teachers, of course, are mainly trying to raise money, basically. This is what they're there for, trying to raise money for the schools, and they're still doing it today. But Hiratonga College was good. They used to have their annual fair, and where the parents worked very hard making things and then trying to sell them at the stalls, and they had the chocolate wheels and all the side fun things, you know. And I looked at this and I talked to the deputy principal. What's his name? Miller. What was his Christian name? Ralph Miller? I think it's Ralph Miller. Yes. I think it's Ralph Miller. And Thurston was the headmaster. But I said to him one day, you know, this is silly. Why don't we sell stalls to some of the local people, like the local hardware shops, so they can show off their lawnmowers and things like this and what's available to the local community, and the seed shops, they can be showing what seeds to be planting and so on. Why don't we, and we can actually sell them a site, you see. So I thought, that's a good idea. So we did it for, I think it was about 2 years, or at least 1 year anyway, and it was very successful. So then I was amazed, because I'm a silly boy for making suggestions, and it always gives work to me then. I said, why don't we take this a bit further and put on a proper industrial show? And I said, like, I know people at Dunlop's and General Motors and things like that. I'll go and have a talk to them and say, show them that they should be showing these new areas, showing what's coming up, what's available. Well, my dream actually roared away, because it was the reaction I got was so positive, I couldn't believe it. And so we ended up now with, where we literally took the whole school over. We sold sections like classrooms and things like that, where they were going to be showrooms. Then there was the outside, and the whole of the football field was all divided up into lots again, which we'd sold to motor, you know, car people and so on. The gymnasium, Dunlop's, that's right, they, to help show their products, put a coating or carpeting, what I call it, a rubber carpeting, right throughout the gymnasium to protect the floor, so that they could have a stall in there, and we could also have other stalls now in the gymnasium, and it was protecting their wonderful floor, you see. So anyway, this went, and we thought, well, now who are we going to get to open the show? So we got the, who was he now? Marshall? He was the Minister of Trade and Industry, I think, something like this. He came to open it. We got Miss New Zealand at the time to come down from New Plymouth and be there and so forth. There was one other, the local mayor, of course, he polished his collar up and came along, because we had some of these MPs arriving. He'd had to be there. So it was quite a success. We had skydivers at the opening too, coming in.
Oh,
and we raised $10,000 in one day. Now, $10,000 in those days was a lot of money. I mean, where we used to make about $500 after all these silly little gala days, we made $10,000, or in round figures, that's $10,000.
What did they use it for?
Well, this was used for just for the school.
Built something pretty major,
right,
with it, couldn't
it? Well, I mean, schools, even today, they didn't require it for, there's not only upkeep, but I mean, there's books and things like that, and camps and so on that the school try and entice for children.
Yeah.
So
it'd go quite a long way.
It was a lot of money. So we ran one. We ran the first one, which was the most successful, and then we actually, in promoting it, we not only had radio time, but managed to get that. But we also had signs right throughout the hut leading to the industrial fair. You see, with the dates on. So just about every second lamppost had a great big sign on it. So we really got the message across. In fact, a little while, when I got well into this, I found myself spending, I think, more time working on that than on my job.
Maybe it won't count it. What year do you reckon it would have been, do you know?
That would have been, jeepers, now what year would it have been? Paul would have been, must have been about 17. 67, 68, somewhere around about then,
yeah.
I think. You could try that for a timing anyway. Yes, I think that'd be about it, yes.
Yeah.
I know we still had the three kids at school. Paul was in his last year, at least, with the... Yeah, I can remember, I know only too well that they were all at school, because on the day before the grand opening for the industrial fair, they had their meeting in the morning, what do you call it, assembly. Mr. Thurston invited me along to go and talk to all the children to energise them into the fact what's going on, you see. So I'm on the stage, and no problem, so I'm on the stage there, and poor Elise, our middle daughter, she's watching me very nervous and very, very embarrassed about it. And she saw me rolling my tongue around inside my mouth, and she knew that was my signal. You do that before you give a public presentation, to loosen up the muscles of your mouth, you see. And she said, she sat there and she was so conscious of me rolling this tongue around. And thought, oh dear, everybody can see Dad doing this. But hell, I hope I didn't embarrass them. So that was the industrial fair, one of the things we got ourselves involved in. What else? We seem to be busy doing a lot of silly things around the hut at that time that young parents can get involved in. But
so you were involved with the lodge. Other organisations or anything?
Any other thing? Not then, I don't think. Since then, yes. I mean, Probus and SeniorNet and all these sort of things, the things that came on later.
Mm.
But no, I didn't really have time for being... at one time, I did used to belong to the Junior Chamber of Commerce. That was very early in the piece, about 1950. When did we get here? 1952, 53. And I joined it for one thing, actually, and that was to get into their public speaking class sessions or group, you know, because I realised this is a real failing for me. I mean, you know, as an engineer, I could do this and do the other and so forth, but to stand up and speak to more than two people at once, I'd never done it in my life. Spoken to one, or maybe two, yes, but to talk to a dozen or more people, that was very foreign. And being with mobile, you had to do things like this. And, you know, running dealer meetings and so. So that's when I joined the Junior Chamber of Commerce, mainly for that. And I won the Hunt Club Cup, the Hunt Cup, I think it was, that's right. Yeah, too, which is good. The subject I used was called self. The word self, a seemingly small, insignificant word, but the whole world sort of floats around that meaning of self. And so we went on. And anyway, so I won that, which was very good. That gave me a lot of confidence from then on.
Yeah. So being in the lodge in Upper Hutt, what kinds of things did the lodge do?
Well, outside of their normal lodge meetings?
Yeah.
Well,
I'm just wondering, do they get involved in external kind of
They do,
things?
But you mostly wouldn't notice them.
Not entirely sure what the lodge do.
Yeah. Well, lodges, they're not a secret society. A lot of people think they are. They're a society with secrets, yes, but every household has certain secrets anyway, and every organisation has secrets, but and so do we. Actually, the secrets are very minimal. I could sit and talk to you for hours about the lodge and what we do and our rituals and how they're formed and so forth. I'm not going to bore you with them here. But if I'm prepared to do that, obviously it's not a secret society. But one of the basic things is brotherly love, relief and truth sort of business. And what do they call it? Charity. And so therefore charity comes in many forms. I mean, you immediately think of putting your hand in your pocket for charity, but that's not necessarily only so. I can go and look after somebody who's very down or has no friends. That's a very charitable act I can be doing. So therefore you look at charity in the very widest extent, and this is what Freemasonry will do. I mean, once you hear of something that's really, you feel this is worthy, then you go and talk to them about it. Well, we can sometimes get behind that particular project, help it on its way, either advising them, maybe finding some money for them and doing so forth to get whatever the problem is. And so it goes. They might be conscious of where that's come from, but outside of it, other people don't know.
Right.
But we run hospitals, we run schools, we have a lot to do with the Auckland University and chairs up there, to do with mainly research work into elderly problems and things like this. So, and there's literally millions of dollars have gone into this. So, but it's all come from there, but you wouldn't know about it.
Right.
But so what? It doesn't matter, it's happening, and so we like to see it. You know. We're not looking for pats on the back or anything like that. So that's what Freemason is all about. Now, they do, in amongst themselves, they have their ladies' nights, and we have our barbecues, and we have things like that, and put on annual balls. That's the thing we miss, I think. Today, other than you do see some of the colleges running annual balls, but you don't see the ball for the younger adults, as we do. And I can show you pictures here of ourselves, you know, all dolled up, and it was nothing to go out, you know, on a Friday or a Saturday, or not Friday, but Saturday nights, and go dancing somewhere at some sort of ball or something where you're actually dressed up.
Who would hold the balls?
Well, they, Masonically, it could be one of the lodges running it, or we did combine them. But then there are balls run by other organisations. Can't even think where they were now, but we used to go out a lot. Oh, we used to go to this, right, across the Majestic Cabaret. Now, do you ever heard? Do you know of the Majestic Cabaret?
Yeah.
That used to be in the Dominion building. No, in the Evening Standard, Evening Post, was it? The paper.
Street.
Yeah.
Was that?
What?
In Willis Street.
In Wellington. That's right. I think the pillars going into the place have been pulled to bits now, but the frontage is still there.
It's where the Majestic Centre is
that's
now,
right.
I think.
Right.
Yeah.
But that used to run every Saturday with the dance on there, but you didn't go along. You went there in dinner jackets, and the girls were on long skirts and things like that. And of course, the interesting was they were all dry. Of course, no alcohol was allowed in there. Was not allowed in there. But when the girls went in, you could hear them, the bottles clinking under their skirts, sneaking an old bottle in. You see, well, there's the only way the men couldn't get. Where could you put it on a man? You can't have it sticking in your pocket. So you give it to your wife, who would tuck it under the skirt and hold it. You see. Maybe two
Did
bottles.
Did your wife sneak in bottles?
She snooked. Oh, yes. So you meet you're going as a group, of course, and then immediately you ask for some, what do they call it, ginger ale, you see. It had another name. What was the name of that, Jean? It wasn't ginger ale, it was something. No, I know. But anyway, you ask for a dozen glasses and six bottles of this ginger ale, we'll say. Well, I think, how the place is that going to see you right through the evening? Well, because it did see you right through the evening, because you had something else to put with the ginger ale. But it was all under the table. I'm sure the police and things like that knew it was going on.
Did anybody ever get caught doing that?
No, I've never seen anybody get caught. Well, they didn't drink to excess. I mean, they had it there to keep a smile on their face and things like that, and we enjoy the evening. But you didn't drink to excess. No, not there. I'm not saying I've never drunk to excess. I certainly have. And Jean has had the odd time too. In fact, I could give you one or two wonderful examples of that. But
don't feel you need to.
Well, I must give you one because I suppose it shows you what type of fun we had in the Hutt Valley. It was a Christmas do at Seaview, which was the depot for a vacuum oil company, and or the manufacturing plant. And we had the Christmas do there, not for children, this is for adults. It's going to be dancing and plenty of booze and so forth. And there was 12 of us coming from Upper Hutt. Well, we decided we weren't going to take six cars. We'll take two cars because they were Holdens. And if you remember rightly, the original Holdens had bench seats in the front and the back. So you could have three in the front quite comfortably, six people in a car. So we take two cars with the six people in. And halfway through the evening, unbeknown to us, the owner of one of the cars, he and his wife, she was a very hard Australian, have a bit of a tiff. And she gets such a huff that she's off. She jumps in the car and goes home to her hut. And it wasn't until just before midnight, we're all still laughing at her, and then we suddenly realised one car's missing, and there's 11 of us here, you see, got to get home. Well, 11 of us get in one car, five in the front and six in the back. and all half sloshed. However, I mean, because it wasn't certainly on the traffic that you get today, but we get back to our hut and gradually offload this seven people out of one car. So we had a lot of fun as a younger day, you know, getting away from it. Breaking the law? Yes, we did. And if anybody called us up that evening, I suppose there wouldn't be enough they could write in their book about it. Overloading the car, drunken drivers, everybody drunk and so forth. But, so yes, we used to have fun that way, but I suppose we knew how to handle it more than anything else, because we never got into trouble or anything like that.
Where would you, if you went out in Upper Hutt, were there places to go out for the evening in Upper
Hutt? Not in Upper Hutt itself. No, cinema, yeah, that was all. The cosy clubs and things like that weren't there. There was a working man's, no, there was the RSA club that was there. Not that I belonged to that. There were halls, well, there was plenty of halls to be hired because schools had halls, you had church halls. You got Masonic halls and so forth. There's plenty of halls that could be let out for functions, yes. And there were, I suppose, more privately, well, not necessarily privately run, but small functions run like by groups of individuals than I think you'd get today. We made our own fun. And I think that spilt to the children too, that they used to make their own fun. In fact, I remember we invited our three along to a Masonic do. It was a ball we were having, you know, we used to run one just for the lodge itself. And we always had a theme, you know, it would be a Bavarian evening or something like that, you see, and everybody had to dress up and so forth. And they came along to this and they turned around to us after and said, "You know, Dad and Mum, we never knew you older people had so much fun." So, I suppose it must have spilled off onto them that way. And I think, I speak for, you know, thinking of Upper Hutt, there were so many young families, that's the way it went. The parents enjoyed themselves, but they made certain the children were cared for, and they saw that the children were cared for in their way too. But gave their time to the kids, and I think the kids then allowed their parents to have some time for themselves. In the early days, it was always getting babysitters, of course, to look after that, and that was really not a big problem because of your neighbourhood, again, and the people you knew. And in fact, Jean and I, we used to have the telephonist from Mobile or from Vacuum Oil. She became a very close friend of the family's, and she came out whenever we wanted a babysitter. She really used to come out and allow us to have the privilege of a night out.
And what about the pubs in Upper Hutt? Do you remember the pubs?
The pubs, the only one I can remember really was the Heratonga. Now, what do they call it? The Wheat? No, the Wheat, not the Wheat. She, gosh, what was the one in the Heratonga? Heratonga. The. Well, of course, in the days we're talking about, you see, there's still 6 o'clock closing. When did it become 10 o'clock closing? That was a lot later, wasn't it?
I think.
That was way in the 70s, getting into the 80s, wasn't it? The 70s, wouldn't be 80s.
67,
was it 67, was it? Blimey, that's earlier than I thought. Ah.
Yeah. So did you go to pubs?
No, we didn't. Other than, say, coming home with the boys on a Friday night, maybe you'd have a couple of beers before you're going home, just driving home. But not to go home and then go out to the pubs, no. We didn't do that, no. I'm not saying it didn't go on, but...
what was it like at the Heratonga pub?
Sorry?
What was the Heratonga pub like?
Oh. Just a lot of people drinking. It wasn't a family affair, I don't think. It was more little groups of people that just went to that area and kept themselves to their own little group, basically. If you went to the Working Men's Club or the RSA, that was different because there was comradeship through their association with the army. So there is a greater feeling in the bar, I think, rather than a little social group of people that have gone there for a few drinks amongst themselves. Can't help you a lot with that, because as I say, I didn't go out. And I was,
yeah.
Not that I wasn't a drinker, but I was drunk at home more than anything else.
Do you remember the A&P shows that I've had?
A&P, yes. Again, I can remember them, only to go down in and out just to take the children to see the horses and things like that, but we didn't get ourselves involved with anything like that. Our daughter Karen, and she might be helping more than that, she was involved with the pony clubs there and got very involved with those. Because I say that was the one that started with her horse at an early age of about 16 and is still a very horsey person. But she had a lot to do with the pony clubs. The only thing I was involved with was really seeing them get there and get home again, and feeding horses at night when my daughter couldn't get out to them. But other than that, I did have very other little to do, no financial involvement or anything like that. Other than to see that we didn't have to cough up anything. Well, that was the deal, just right from the word go, anyway.
And do you remember, did you go to the celebrations for when Upper Hutt became a city?
Not any of the, no, the only celebration we went to was just the parade and the final wind-up of the parade. No, we didn't go to any of the, did we, dear? I don't think we did. No, we didn't. We didn't. It was, what celebration we did as in our own little community, which wasn't an organised thing, it was just, you know, just a community, or we are a city and talking about it and having a social evening. But we didn't go to any functions, let's put it that way.
How did, so you said you had a little celebration with your friends?
Yes.
For Upper Hutt becoming a city?
Well, no, we used to celebrate with them for any reason whatsoever, you see. And so we would have done something like that, but it was just a matter of, you'd be in one house with a load of people that we know, you know, or we'd go to somebody else's house and have a function. They were all sort of, private, individual functions with up to 20 or 30 people, I suppose, there. Don't get away from that. But it was always in one of their houses. And our house became very well known for New Year's Eve. We'd run some very good evening New Year's Eve parties. And I can remember on one of the particular occasions, we had a very hilarious time. We made people dress up for it, of course. I think they all came as hippies. But one of our friends, their son-in-law, was a very quiet individual, very quiet. He wouldn't say boo to a goose. But he did belong to the local pipe band. And unbeknown to us, we were all getting a bit silly there just before midnight, and suddenly on the front lawn burst into Auld Lang Syne with a pipe spray, and it's our friend's son-in-law out there. And we thought, my guys, they're all outside, this is good, you know. And we're at that sort of merriness, you know, we're going to join in with this one, so everybody's singing Auld Lang Syne and dancing around the lawn. And suddenly down the street comes a little old lady tearing along with a bottle in her hand, and she's broad Scotch and wanting to meet the master of the house, you see, to have a dram with her, you see, and so forth. She's being followed by two people who were most embarrassed. Apparently this woman was out from Scotland, and she couldn't believe New Year's Eve, or Hogmanay as they call it, was celebrated in such a dull life, you see. And she suddenly heard these bagpipes playing and thought, there it is, it's bagpipes. And she had to go out to find it. It's the party. That's right. And then, because in Scotland, first footing is the big thing, isn't it? And so she wanted to do first footing. And so she comes in and we have our noggin and she, so forth, and stayed for about an hour, I suppose, meeting everybody, and then just disappeared as quickly as she came. So it made her evening and it made ours as well. But I'll never get Murray in those bagpipes when he went suddenly burst into Auld Lang Syne. I mean, if somebody did that, like we were talking just now, and there's kids next door playing the drums, that's annoying us. Well, I mean, it's in the middle of the day. Imagine if it was at midnight, it'd be different, wouldn't it? But we didn't think of it in that time. So I never really found out what the neighbours thought about it.
I don't have to make a noise.
Go on.
But you're recording it?
Yes.
What? Oh, no, it's a big noise.
It's a big noise?
Yes.
Should I turn off the recorder?
Yes. Well, yes. Yeah.